Welcome to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and advanced physics students from Roaring Fork Valley High Schools. The students spend a week working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the distinguished physicists who are here. I'm Patty Fox, and I'm hosting today's program, which was recorded during the teen summer program at the Aspen Center for Physics. With me today are Chloe Bretman and Mason DeBoeuf, rising seniors from Aspen High School. They will be interviewing Ajay Gopinathan from the University of California, Merced, which is the 10th and newest campus of the University of California system. He is currently the chair of the Department of Physics and also serves as director of the National Science Foundation Center for Cellular and Biomolecular Machines. His current research involves using theoretical and computational methods to understand biological transport and biological machinery at the molecular, cellular, and multicellular scales. In particular, he's interested in understanding how living systems are able to transport material with high fidelity in extremely noisy and disordered environments. A couple of years ago, he gave a kids program on flocking here at the Aspen Science Center, co-hosting our picnics. So he's very experienced.
How did you get into physics?
I think I've been interested in physics as far as I can remember from the time I first encountered it, which was in sixth grade. And so till then, we just had science as one subject. And then in sixth grade, we had this physics and chemistry and mathematics all split up. And, you know, physics was particularly fascinating to me. I mean, I was good at math, but then physics was something else, because what it brought to me was the idea that you could actually explain everything that you saw around you in terms of simple equations, that there were simple physical laws that governed how everything worked. And not just everything around you, you know, the stars and, you know, the inflation of the universe and things of that sort. So I started getting into reading a lot of popular science books about physics. And I even one particular thing that sticks in my mind is a biography of Einstein. And I was like, just, you know, my mind was blown that somebody could just sit in a patent office and think of things of how the universe worked, right? And so I was like, that's what I want to be, a theoretical physicist. And so as I, you know, went into high school, I kept reading, you know, more advanced books on physics. Yeah, you know, started reading about quantum mechanics, but also on the popular science side, read about, you know, Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking. And of course, on the lighter side, I read all of Feynman's, you know, biographies. And so I was like, that's a cool physicist and a theoretical physicist. That's what I want to be. Anyway, so I was always interested in theoretical physics. And so it wasn't much of a decision for me. And so when I went to college, I chose to do physics. And then it's been that way since.
And the majority of your work has revolved around specifically the field of biophysics. I was wondering if, kind of for the audience that may not be familiar with it, you could describe that field itself and kind of describe how you became acquainted with it.
Okay.
And I know you had got your PhD at UChicago, kind of how you explored it in your college career, the work that you did early on, things of that sort.
So that's like a two-part question. There's the question of what is biophysics in general, and then how I became acquainted with it. So it's interesting because biophysics means a lot of different things to different people. And so the answer to this question will depend on who you ask. But biophysics in itself, I mean, many people think of it as a new emerging field, you know, merging physics and, you know, quantitative biology together. But if you think about it, the history of biophysics goes quite a way back. And so, you know, you can think of Volta, right, and people like that, and Galvani, who did these experiments of electricity through frogs' legs, right? And so you could pass electricity and the frogs' legs would twitch. And so those are all actually really biophysical experiments, because they're looking at physical things like electricity and how that played a role in biological systems like frogs. And of course, and this was, you know, in the 1700s, but even before that, you heard of Robert Hooke, who was a famous physicist, and of course a polymath, architect, and lots of other things. But Hooke, you know, came up with the microscope, and he is the first person to, you know, actually look at living organisms with a microscope, and he described those in great detail, and even had inklings of this theory of evolution simply from his observations. So that's, to me, also biophysics. So you're using tools from physics, like, you know, a microscope, to actually study biological systems. So if you ask me, that's a part of biophysics, is using tools and techniques from physics to study biological systems and problems and that have importance in biology. But at the same time, as a physicist, I feel that, you know, learning something new about physics from these studies is what makes biophysics unique. And so you're trying to understand, not just using the tools, but then trying to understand how physical principles and physical laws govern biological systems as well, right? So that's kind of what I feel about biophysics. But then how did I get into biophysics? So it's a longer route, I guess. As an undergraduate, I did a couple of projects that were in statistical mechanics and statistical physics. And so statistical physics is when you think about large collections of things and how they behave together and kind of emergent properties that come when you put a large number of things together. So everything around us, I mean, when you think about physics, you know, you might consider studying like one atom or one electron or one particle. But most things around us are composed of many, many, you know, trillion atoms and molecules. And so trying to understand how that happens is, you know, using statistical mechanics. And so I did a project on statistical mechanics. But then when I went to, for my PhD, I chose to study things that were related to statistical mechanics, looking at polymers, looking at elasticity in sheets. But then if you think about it, all of these things actually were leading in the direction of biophysics, because biological systems are also composed of proteins, which are basically polymers. They have membranes, which are sheets. And so all of my things that I did in my PhD actually translated to biology. And so as a postdoc, that's when I first came across biophysics. I'd done a little course on biophysics as a PhD student, which was very interesting. But it was as a postdoc that I first started working. And so I applied my knowledge of polymers to understand how polymers could exert forces inside cells. So that was my transition to biophysics.
Awesome. So in terms of biophysics, how does using that knowledge and that subject help us learn more about, so some of your research has been about transport, so how does that help us learn about, I guess, very small ecosystems, so like on the scale of a cell, mm-hmm. I know is what a lot of your work is about.
Yeah, so so a lot of my work is on transport inside cells, and so, which is a fascinating subject, you might, and why do you need transport inside cells in the first place, right? And so, you know, as a living being, you know, you are always out of equilibrium, right? So your system is driven, you're always consuming energy. And so you're always fighting against what's called entropy, right? Which just wants to make you a big bag of, you know, goop. Right? That's what you would become, right, eventually. But that's, you know, your body, you're eating food in order to, you know, combat that. So even that happens even at the cellular level. So cells have, you know, they have nuclei which contain all the DNA, the genetic information, which is kind of like a blueprint for what the cell should be doing. And then there are other organelles that are spaced out inside the cell. So there's the mitochondrion, which produces ATP, which is like a powerhouse. So you can actually make an analogy to a city. So you have the nucleus, which all the information is like a library or a city hall. Your mitochondrion, which produces energy, is like a power factory. You have the endoplasmic reticulum, which produces proteins, and that's like a factory. So you can make all these analogies. And just as in a city, you need to have transport between different entities like this. You need to have the same kind of transport systems inside a cell. And just as we have road networks and delivery vehicles, inside cells we have these protein filaments. They're cytoskeletal filaments made of proteins like actin, microtubules, and a few other intermediate filaments. And so this network provides structure to the cell, but also serves as a road network to carry things along. And so there are these tiny molecular motors that actually walk along these filaments, dragging cargo from one place to the other. And that's critical in order for the cell to actually function. So lots of cellular functions like response to signals, for example, when you eat a lot of sugar, your pancreatic cells have to, secretes insulin. And that's an export process, and that's driven by this very transport process that I'm telling you about. So these cells then carry these insulin little vesicles with insulin to the outer boundary of the cell, and then they get excreted. And so what I use is theoretical computational techniques. So I actually worry about the forces that are being exerted by these motors as they walk along the microtubule. I worry about how the design of the road network affects transport. So you could have poorly designed networks where you can have a lot of jamming and trapping, right? So the question is, how does a cell, engineer this network so that this doesn't happen? How does a cell engineer the network so that you have robust transport in a reasonable amount of time, right? So you want to avoid all these traps and jams and things of that sort. And again, it's useful to use statistical mechanics and statistical physics because this is a probabilistic process. So you can't, you're not trying to describe every single cargo starting at point A and ending at point B. What you want to know is on average, what happens to a cargo? Does it end up at point B? Okay, and how long would it take on average? Because it's a probabilistic process because the environment inside the cell is very noisy. So these little motors that are carrying this cargo, they fall off these trucks every once in a while. So this is like if I'm driving from City Hall to the power factory or something, and if my car is hit by boulders and I'm knocked off the road every once in a while, and then I tumble around and find another road and then drive on that and then get kicked off of that, that's the process that these motors have to deal with. And so the question is, in that noisy environment, you can't actually describe a straight line path, all the way from one point to the other. You have to think of the probability of starting at one point and then ending at another. And so we use these tools of statistical mechanics, and we do a lot of simulations, computations, to figure out, how changing these networks, how changing the properties of the motors, how changing how many motors you have on a single cargo, how all of these things affect this transport. So, this was a long answer, but hopefully that was informative.
Certainly. You talked about the kind of your use of computational techniques and assessing this big, fascinating network of transport. Are there any sort of new arenas or sort of new aspects of computational techniques that have opened up new opportunities within the field, or opportunities to see a certain aspect of transport or anything that wasn't apparent beforehand?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. So I would say more, rather than on the computational and theoretical side, there's been a lot of more experimental progress that have actually allowed us to access what's going on inside these cells at very high resolution. So I think the techniques that we use from the theory and computation side are fairly standard, but what we lack in this field, specifically this field, is high-quality data, quantitative data, about this transport process, okay? So there are very few labs that are working really hard on trying to understand this because it's very hard to look inside a cell and watch things go from one point to another because there's a lot of stuff going on inside a cell. But people have been able to develop new techniques of microscopy that give you unprecedented resolution in both space and time. And what that allows you to do is then actually figure out what these particular cargos are doing when they go inside the cell. So you can label these cargos with, for example, quantum dots, and then you could watch, you could actually engineer your own cargos with quantum dots with different amounts of motors on them and watch as they walk through these networks. Another interesting advance is like moving, trying to, so if a physicist always try to make clean experiments, but the cell is a very dirty place, right? Because there's a lot of stuff going on. So creating systems in vitro, that is outside the cell, that mimic what's going on inside the cell, but in a simple setup, so you actually know everything that goes in there, is very useful. And so people have actually started doing that now. So taking these filaments that transport occurs along inside cells, and then putting them in microfluidic channels, producing these networks controllably, and then using cargo that are labeled. So now you don't have to worry about all the other junk in the cell. You can study your cargo walking along these networks. And that's an enormous amount of information. And I'm fortunate to have collaborators who can do this. And so now I have access to their data, and we can actually, you know, do theoretical analysis, do our simulations, and see how closely we match up with the experimental data.
So I guess going off of that a little bit, once you have a better grasp of certain concepts that you're studying, what's the bigger picture application?
So yeah, so if we're restricting ourselves to, let's say, intracellular transport, then as I mentioned, this kind of transport is very important for cellular function. So disruptions in these kind of transport can lead to a lot of different diseases, particularly neurodegenerative diseases. Huntington's and Alzheimer's and all of these, in all of these cases, you know, transport is breaks down. And so the question that we are trying to address is not trying to cure these diseases, but trying to figure out the basic physics of how these transport works inside these cells. But now you can see where I'm going with this, which is that if you have a good handle on how transport works, then you also have a good handle on trying to influence that transport or trying to mimic that transport, okay? So, for example, if you wanted to deliver some drugs, then these drugs are taken up and then they maybe be transported along these same networks. Viruses also hijack these networks to get their, their genetic information to the cellular nucleus. So all of these processes depend on transport. And so if we understand how to influence transport, you know, we have a shot at trying to, you know, in the long run, cure some of these diseases or create new biomimetic systems that, you know, mimic these kinds of transport processes so you can, you know, make transport better. So for example, we actually now look at real networks within cells and then transfer that network image to our computers and try to figure out what the transport is on those real cellular networks. So the idea is we're moving towards a goal where we will be able to predict whether networks in certain cells are healthy or diseased, and then we can predict, you know, what could you do to actually change that. So that's for intracellular transport.
Great. Kind of change the topic a bit. What is a certain aspect or some research within the field of physics or biophysics specifically that has like caught your attention and that you think, or one that you kind of think that has gone underappreciated by the public or the scholarly community, just generally something that you'd like people to know about more?
Well, so I don't know if I would say this has been underappreciated, but this question of collective behaviors in these biological systems. So thinking about flocks and swarms, okay? So it may seem a little childish, right? Why do you want to study flocks and swarms, right? But it turns out there's some very interesting deep physics about flocking and swarming, and also big connections to biology, okay? Clearly, because we're talking about flocks and swarms. So one of the interesting things about flocking and swarming or collective behaviors in these systems generally is that if you think about a flock of birds, like if you're thinking about a starling flock, for example, you might have seen these like swooping changes of the flock as a whole. They have thousands of them. Or you can even think of millions and millions of locusts. Okay, they form swarms as well. So the question there is, how do such a large number of entities coordinate their movement without any map of where they're going, without any real instructions, and without any leaders? Okay. So that's a very fascinating subject. And from the physics perspective, we do know that, you know, dead materials also exhibit collective phenomena in condensed matter physics. So a simple example is a magnet. A magnet is a collective phenomenon. So you can raise it to a high temperature. All the little tiny spins inside it, which are each tiny little magnets, will point in all different directions. And so that piece of metal is no longer a magnet. But if you lower the temperature at a certain point, all of these tiny spins will align with each other. And there's no general rule telling them which direction they need to be aligning in. But they, what they do is they interact with their neighbors and come to a consensus direction and align themselves. And so the same thing happens in flocks. So the idea is that every fish in a school or every bird in a flock has access to information about their neighbors. So they can see where their neighbors are going, and they can generally align their direction of motion with their, those of their neighbors. And that gives rise, and this information propagates and gives rise to the collective motion of flocks. And so something that is kind of, and so this is actually quite well appreciated. There's a lot of physicists that are studying flocks and swarms. And for myself, I'm also studying not just the general phenomena, I'm also looking at, you know, clusters of cells that move during embryogenesis, for example, during development, during cancer. So all of these, there are actual, you know, biological, this is an actual biological process where you have small clusters of cells moving together. And these same principles apply there as well. How do these cells coordinate their movement? How do they know where to go? But something that's been underappreciated, which I've been trying to, which I've been working on, and I think would benefit more people's involvement in, is looking at how disorder and heterogeneity play a role in these flocks and swarms or clusters of cells. And the idea being that if you take a general flock of birds, not every bird is identical, right? So they don't all respond the same way. Neither is every fish in a school identical. So there's some heterogeneity in their behavior. They may behave slightly differently from their neighbors. So something that is now people are beginning to look at is, how does this heterogeneity, this difference in behavior between agents in a flock or swarm or cluster of cells, how does that affect the behavior of the whole? Okay, so we've done some interesting work. We found out, for example, that if there are a small fraction of, you know, agents who don't actually obey the rules and interact with others, the swarm can spontaneously eject them from the group. Huh. So because if there are too many of these non-cooperators in the group, then the group can't reach a consensus decision and move. But if you allow the group to do its own thing, eventually these, you know, cheaters or non-cooperators can get expelled, right? And then the group can take off. And so we've shown this. So this is just an example of something interesting that could happen. And this is purely a physical phenomenon. It's not that they are thinking about it and deciding, oh, that you are a non-cooperator, you leave. It's just the dynamics of the system itself, you know, expels these cheaters. So things, interesting things like this can happen.
Thank you, Ajay Gopinathan, from the University of California, Merced, a founder thereof, and Chloe Bretman and Mason DeBoeuf, rising seniors from Aspen High School. If you'd like to know more about our Gopher program, which is what the high schoolers are here doing, please give me a call and listen to Radio Physics the fourth Tuesday of every month at 4:30. Thank you.